2 days ago, the Library of Congress placed over 10,000 historical sound recordings at our fingertips. I mean, you just press a button on its national jukebox and the music plays. But what about the copyright issues? I mean, certainly something had to be worked out with Sony. And what about the daunting range of technical and operational issues that had to be overcome to bring the jukebox into being? How did they do it? Well, we're fortunate enough to have several of the jukebox's prime movers on our podium this morning. Here to introduce them and the Library of Congress's National Jukebox is Sam Berlowski, who in this crowd really needs no introduction. Sam?
Thank you. So I'm going to sit here while they work out the, make sure that PowerPoint works. I want to answer Steve Smalley real fast, too. The Google music thing announced was really more like Amazon's arrangement, which was a cloud computing thing where you could store your music online. There's a controversy about whether you need permission to do that, but it isn't really like iTunes yet. But I think that what a case in point is, as Tim said, we have a lot of allies. We even have allies in the record industry on some of our positions. Ours is supported performing rights. We're not like this knee-jerk copy left movement. This is a very complicated issue. Anyway, I can't resist pointing that out. In any case, to talk about the National Jukebox, as David said, on Tuesday, the Library of Congress turned on the switch to make 10,300 acoustical 78 RPM sides available, all made by the Victor Talking Machine Company, available on the web for streaming. The response to this website has been literally overwhelming. I'm surprised by the amount of the kind of support it's gotten, the kind of press it's gotten. The response has not just been media attention, but actually a lot of users and a lot of interesting web buzz. In the past few days, the number of simultaneous users of the National Jukebox has ranged between 700 to 1,200 or more at one time. The website was described by one veteran IT employee and journalist as the kind of project that makes you fall in love with the web all over again. Someone else wrote in a comment, "I'm giving Pandora the day off." Last night at the reception, Kurt Nock pointed out to me that the day that the jukebox launched was Kurt's 50th birthday. Now, you're not going to say happy birthday to him on our time because we have a lot to cover, but we think it's very appropriate that this was launched on Kurt's birthday, not just because of Kurt's interest and commitment to historical recordings, to 78s and other acoustical recordings, but also just because of the support. We're so gratified that something that was celebrated, that started on Kurt's birthday, has received the most attention from one of Kurt's favorite journalists, Rachel Maddow, Rachel Maddow described the jukebox and the creators of the jukebox as those from the Library of Coolness. I worked at the Library of Congress a long time. Needless to say, it was never called the Library of Coolness when I was there. Someone who commented on Rachel Maddow's website called it, "This is so nerd rad," and something else that I sort of always aspired toward, to be nerd rad. Anyway, in this opening session, I want to give you, we're going to provide you some background and some commentary on the creation of the jukebox. The planning for the jukebox began over 6 years ago. The production of the jukebox has been in place for more than 2 years. It's a very, very complex project. Many, many people worked on it on both coasts in three different cities, and they worked to get it right. Some of them are here today. We can't recognize them all. Two of the main players are sitting next to me, but we're going to review the website. We're going to go into some of its features. We're going to lift the hood to reveal what's under it, what's behind the website. We're going to assess some of its successes, and we're going to review some of the learning experiences associated with creating the jukebox. There's been incredible support by all the parties. The University of California, for which I work, is generally generously provided data, metadata, for descriptive metadata for the jukebox, and been sort of the model, the guinea pig for a cooperative approach and looking at mass digitization. From inception, we'd hoped that private collectors, who hold so many now really virtually unique recordings, would join us in this project, and setting the model for that has been David Giovannoni and Mark Lynch, who have loaned their collection of early Victor recordings to the project that David Sagel will review for you. A quick word on my involvement. My association with the project does begin about 7 years ago. I am the editor of the Victor Discography Project, University of California, Santa Barbara, and this project has always, it's been conceived of not only as a comprehensive and sort of authoritative, hopefully authoritative, documentation of the Victor Talking Machine Company and RCA Victor 78s, but also as a popular, a possible cataloging tool. Many people worked on my project as well. Carrie is here somewhere, and he's worked on Dick Spotswood for years. In any case, we always saw it as, you know, potential to have a discography that's not just for scholars and collectors, but also maybe this data could be migrated to catalog. At the same time, when I worked at the Library of Congress, we sort of tried to get access to historical recordings and sought permission from copyright holders with absolutely no success. We approached a record company executive who was pretty much open to it. He was fired within months. We had nothing to do with that. We also approached the RIAA and were turned down by them. So it's appropriate that this is combined with a copyright session, and I want to make you aware of, in fact, that Tim Brooks and Steve Simoleon's study that was commissioned by the National Recording Preservation Board many years ago, the one that found that 14% of pre-1965 recordings, historical recordings, are made accessible by their rights holders. That report is literally what led to the cooperation of Sony Music Entertainment in this jukebox. Upon learning of that report and reading it, they approached the Library of Congress and said, "This is serious. We would like to help you do something with it. Send us a proposal." So we worked up a proposal for them, and that's, you know, where the jukebox started. That was 6 or 7 years ago. So here we have the opportunity to test discographies and access and how discographies can be used in what young people, librarians, call discovery. And because of using the Victor discography, that's why the jukebox is now 10,300 Victor sides. We hope that this project has been conceived from the very beginning as being extensible, and we hope many, many other recordings will be added to it. But we wanted it to be comprehensive. We chose Victor because of the data, but also the wide range of the kinds of recordings that Victor produced before 1925. The license from Sony, of course, is for acoustical recordings only. We want to be comprehensive. We want to include all the recordings, not just the treasures that Victor put out, but include the mediocre records and Nipper's yard waste as well. They're all among these 10,300 recordings. At the end, I'm going to speak about some of the future of this project and how it might be expanded. The reason we're here specifically, and I'm here, is Gene Deanna, who is the project director. He's the head of the recorded sound section. He couldn't make it to the conference today. His son graduated from college yesterday at the University of Tennessee. I had to leave the conference early for the same good reason. It's not my son, but my daughter's graduating. Dawn Frank, who is in charge of the library's recording laboratory, is also at a graduation and a family event and was planning to come, but then had this conflict of schedules. So Catlin Hunter is going to be picking up and carrying the weight for both Gene and Dawn to talk about the project as a whole, Dawn's contribution, and the very significant contribution of Catlin's section, the processing section of the recorded sound section at the Library of Congress. Following Catlin, David Soibert will talk a little more about Santa Barbara's contributions and our experiments with different kinds of digitization. So I'm going to turn this over to Catlin now.
Good morning, everyone. I'm really glad that you can see this because I was trying to figure out in my head how I was going to talk about the site. I'm going to basically be giving a tour through a PowerPoint presentation. It won't be a live tour, but I'm going to point out some of the features, some of the things you might not know about, and if you have questions later, certainly come up to me. If you want me to go through some things on the website with you over the next 2 days, I can sit down in the lobby and do that as well. The second presentation I'm going to do is sort of worked on at LC from kind of the beginning to sort of the final product here. I want to say that this is the first version of the website. It will change a lot over time. We have a lot of additional features we want to add, and maybe some additional labels and that type of thing are upcoming. So I'm going to start off with the home page, and it's a long page, and you're probably not going to be able to see a lot of this, unfortunately, but I'm going to go through the different elements, just kind of explain it to you. I'm going to spread it out over three slides. Now, the whole point of the home page is to kind of introduce the project and allow people to explore. A lot of you will know a lot about these recordings, but a lot of people out in the world don't. So this is, you know, the purpose is just to kind of give them, try this, try that, and what have you. I don't know that that's showing up really well, but You got it? Okay. At the very top of the page, there's a search box. It's just a keyword search box. And for those of you interested in searching specific catalog numbers, right now, this is the place to go. There is a link off to the right for advanced search, and I'll go over that a little bit later. Below that is a player, and these were just some selections that are the curatorial assistant for this project selected to kind of introduce the type of sound recordings to people. They can check out different sounds and different kinds of things. And right below that is a box about the National Jukebox. So it gives kind of hints for people who have not come here before. Here's some things to explore. Here's information about takes and that kind of thing. On the right, at the very bottom, which you might just see a little bit of there, is the top of the 1919 Victrola Book of the Opera. And we have also a link to this in the left navigation bar. We chose the image because people might think, oh, it's just a resource and it might be kind of boring, but we've added a little something to it and also has some really interesting pictures in it. So I'm going to go on. This is the middle of the homepage. It's basically a bunch of paths to certain aspects of the page, some random recordings, some playlists. It goes to an artist page, which I'll discuss in a little bit, and a genre page. And then we have news and coming soon areas to kind of brief people on new additions and things we're planning on doing in the near future. And this is the very bottom of the page. How'd they do that? We do have a slideshow of what we did at the Library of Congress, different people doing different things, so it's kind of fun. And just give people more information about acoustical recording, and a lot of people don't know what takes are, so there's a little information about that. And we also provided links to similar projects, both within the Library of Congress and outside. So I'm gonna talk about the different aspects of the left navigation bar, and that's basically browse all recordings, artists, genres, jukebox day by day, playlists of recordings, and the Victrola Book of the Opera. Browse all recordings, these categories came from EDVR, and the amount of work we would have had to do to actually manually enter this would be astounding. So the cooperative nature of this whole project was massive from my perspective. What this does is it gives you a broad category and then a bunch of things beneath it so you can kind of go in and begin to explore. And what this is, although you can't see it very well, is the beginning of the composer list. These entries are ordered by number of hits. It's not alphabetical. So it's kind of fun to see that Charles Gounod has more hits than Puccini right now in the system and that type of thing. We have an artist browse feature. And this is kind of divided into two parts at the moment. The top, we did some pages where we included images and brief biographical sketches of various artists. And some of them are in this top little slide. You can click on it, it will go to their artist page. There are little arrows off to the side to go forward and back. So that's kind of an initial exploratory aspect. But below that is the browse artists A through Z. This is by last name. So if you're looking for Billy Murray, you're gonna go to M, that type of thing. And I'll show you an example here, the B's. Two and three down is Fred Bachman. And one great thing about this is it actually breaks down like the instrument they played or the role they had. So there are distinct entries for each of those. Then there's a recording date range. And what that is, the recording date range in the jukebox. So it doesn't necessarily reflect, you know, what they did overall, but it is within the jukebox. And then it shows you the number of hits. So that's kind of fun. This is an example of an artist browse, or an artist page with the picture and the text of the bio. What I want to kind of point your attention to is at the bottom where they actually start listing some of the sound recordings. There are headings of these different columns of information, and you can click on those headings and sort all the results by that. So that's kind of nice if you want to see a chronological view of all the recordings that we have in the system for that particular person. We have a genre browse. Now, this was not EDVR based. We actually had to come up with these, and there was a lot of discussion, and there will probably continue to be some discussion about our choices. We may add some things, may change some things. But we had sort of broad headings. In this case, you'll see classical music, ethnic characterizations, popular music, religious, and spoken word. And then we had some subheadings. We chose for classical only opera as a subheading at this point because that's such a major thing at that particular point in time. Here's an example of the popular music choices. And if you can't see them, we've got blues, ethnic music, humorous songs, musical theater, ragtime, jazz, and more, traditional country, whistling, and yodeling. Not your usual ones there at the end. I did want to kind of point out that I've got ethnic characterizations at the top as a broad heading and ethnic music below as a subheading. We had a lot of discussion about the fact that there is true ethnic music that comes out of these ethnic groups on record, but we also have a bunch of this popular music where we're kind of dealing with these ethnic groups, how they were portrayed through stereotypes. And people were having a real difficult time with that, so we wanted to separate them because they are distinctly different concepts. If you click on one of these, this is kind of the result you're going to get. It's a list of different recordings with a little thumbnail of the label. You can sort these by relevance. That's something we're still developing. And you can sort it by title. You can see 20 items or 40 items a page. And in this instance, there's a refine option on the left. So according to mostly EDVR data that pre-existed, you can kind of go, okay, I want to change this to only these recordings that Henry Burr performed on and that type of thing. The next feature is the jukebox day by day. This is really just kind of a fun feature. You can go and put in your birthday and see all the things that can, you know, were done on this. I put May 12th today. But it's also nice if you're kind of wondering sort of who was in the recording studio on a specific day. And it's a great way if you happen to know a day something was recorded and if there were multiple takes to just come here and quickly identify these and play them, you know, one after the other. So playlists of recordings. This is the page you first get to when you click that link. And basically our curatorial assistant came up with a bunch of playlists to explore different types of songs or songs by a specific composer, and you can click on these and get a page like this, which provides some description and then lists a bunch of the things that were put in the playlist. If you click on the title, you'll go to what's called a recording details page, which I'll talk about later, but it basically talks about, you know, all the different people, the composers, the artists, specifics about the recording matrix take. You can click on that little blue playlist icon off to the side, and that will add that to a playlist for you. There's also an option to add all to your playlist, and so you can do that. And the benefit with adding things to a playlist is it'll play consecutively. You don't have to worry about it stopping and then you having to click play again. So that's something to keep in mind. Here's an example of a playlist player. And I did a little mouse over to show that, you know, we basically have the title in there right now and a time, but we're going to fill out more information so that you don't have to worry about the playlist entries being all, you know, too much information to digest. If you need more information, you'll be able to mouse over. I also wanted to point out, although I don't know that you can see them, some of the icons. There are up and down arrows so you can move things within playlists. There's a red sort of audio icon. The idea is you can click that and I believe it will go mute. So for some reason, even though you've saved this playlist, you don't want to listen to certain things at a particular time, you can do that. There's also a circle with an X, and that means you can delete things from your playlist. There is a page on Playlist Basics, so I just want to point that out because it might be a little confusing at first. And then one of the really neat features about this is you can share these with your friends via email or through social networking sites. So basically what I just did is quickly created one of some various imitations I found and posted it on Facebook. And people can go right there and click on it and it'll open up and they can play it. Okay, now I'm going to talk about the Victrola Book of the Opera. And this slide is mainly just to point out that in the upper right, there are some controls that you need to be aware of, because that will help you navigate and do different things. Sometimes the page opens up and you can't see those, so just be aware that they are there. There are different ways to navigate. You can click the arrow buttons in the control area. You can click on pages, and you'll get kind of this little flip the page as if you actually have a book feature. Or you can click, there's an icon for operas, and it'll give you a list of operas, and you can scroll through it, click on what you want, and go to it, right directly to it. Now, anything that we've actually managed to digitize the audio to that they're citing here in the book will be marked by a little blue play icon. So we did match these up. We still have some to do. But I want to just point out, I did a little zoom here. This gives you an opportunity to kind of compare quickly a lot of performances of the same aria. So that's kind of fun, yeah. Okay, on to advanced search. Basically, what I kind of want to point out here is these elements all work with each other. So you could put something up in the top search terms box and something below and, you know, really restrict your searches. What I did right here is I put RAG as a search term under title. And these are the results I got. Now, again, you can sort by relevance or title, see 20 to 40 items. But this is what's called a list view. There's also the gallery view. So that brings a lot more close together that you can look at. It does have a little less metadata with it right now. We need to explore how we're going to deal with that. If you click on one of these, you will get to what's called the recording details page. And I want to quickly point out that this is below the player. That's a tab. There is a tab right next to it that's called rights and access. And if you're curious about the source recording that you're going to be listening to, where it came from, that's where that information is located. In the recording details page, as I mentioned earlier, you've got, you know, the performers, the composer. This is the bottom half of a different recording. Information specific about the recording. And then again, if there's a related take, we do have an area at the bottom that identifies that. So you can go and click on that and, again, listen back and forth if you want. And we did scan the labels. We tried to get the runoff so when... This is not an example where you see this, but if there's, you know, a take or matrix written in or whatever, you can actually see that. And that's sort of the end of the tour. So, if I can get this done. So I'm going to start with preparation for digitization. And first, there was kind of a question, at least from the processing unit area, of what we were going to work on. The curatorial assistant came up initially with a list of specific recordings. And this was because we had a concern that we might get too heavy in later recordings, or too heavy in early, or too heavy in a certain genre. And so we want to make sure we had a breadth of options to deal with. But once UCSB got on board, we then had to deal with the coordination of who's going to do what. And it became a lot easier to say, OK, you're going to start with this range. And when you're done, we'll come in afterwards and check the ones that you didn't have, and kind of work together like that. And that turned out to work quite well. We have ranges of 78s in different vaults out at Culpeper. And to pull all these items, we need to create pull lists so that the technicians knew what they were going to be grabbing. Initially, I was having to individually create these spreadsheets with the different numbers and the title based upon the information David Sager had provided in his initial lists, and also look for re-releases because we wanted to try to get the best copy of something. We ended up creating a project database. We didn't create it, it was properly sorted, created it. This improved the process immensely. It contained EDVR data and LC-specific data, so if we did have a copy and we knew about it in Sonic or elsewhere, it would actually tell the technicians where to look for these copies, so that helped a lot. It retrieved re-release information without me having to search EDVR for it, which was a huge time saver. And it allowed the individuals who were comparing the copies to know ahead of time sort of what the matrix take combinations they needed to consider were, rather than it being a mystery when they first encountered the discs. So this is just a little screenshot from part of a pull list. And the main point was these show matrix take combos. The first is B6356, take two. There are two entries for that, and one is issue number 105, and the other one 6016. So the technicians immediately knew what they were comparing and what they were looking for. As I mentioned, there were several runs of 78 discs in the vaults, and we were not Victor experts when we started this project. So we had to go through a lot of training of, you know, how you determine what the matrix number is and the take, and what if you see something different than what you see in EDVR, and how do you assess the condition? It wasn't an easy thing. And we had to do several different training sessions and rewrite and rewrite documents and that type of thing. I think we're getting pretty good at that as we've gotten quite a few done. Here's just a little snapshot of some of the technicians pulling items in the vaults. See, we have a disk examining room, which is really nice. So we have a bunch of tables. They can put out a bunch and compare them all. And I think the most I heard anybody had to compare was 30, which is a lot. We did have some file name conventions set up from the beginning, which turned out to be extremely helpful and sometimes a little problematic. They would fill out this file element slip by looking at both the disk and EDVR for different elements. And then once we created the project database, they continued that, but they could go into the database, they could claim a file name, and that way the other partner would know, okay, I don't need to digitize that. Huge time saver, so you don't have to evaluate these duplicates after the fact. And this is just an example. The red highlighted item, UCSB had claimed it, so we would know we're not going to. These were the elements we included in our file names, the source of the original item, the label name, the catalog number, the copy number, the matrix number, and the take number. Now, my examples at the bottom, if you look at the very end of each file name, the first one has a 02 and the second one has a 00. We were not able to determine the take for the second one. And when that happened, we put a 00, and that shows up slightly different in the recording details pages. Keep talking. We did clean and resleeve all our disks. And now I'll talk a little bit about audio digitization. I am not an audio engineer, I'm just letting you know that. But if you have questions about it, certainly come to me and I can pass those on. After we did the cleaning and resleeving, the engineers would come down and they'd put a bunch of disks into a padded cart and take it upstairs. They took it to what we call an A1 room. These are very specialized rooms. It's one-on-one, one engineer to an object. It's not, you know, several items going at once. We had 4 to 5 engineers working on this, rotating in 2-hour shifts. So that kind of kept interest going. They didn't flag energy-wise too much, and we got about sometimes 8 hours a day in. And this is kind of just a general overview of the engineer workflow, but as the head of the lab pointed out, it's really not much different from our regular preservation workflow. So we did, you know, worry about stylus choice. We've got a bunch sitting out there to choose from. There was some pitching going on if we knew what the key was, just to try to figure out what speed we should be transferring this at. And then here are just some technical aspects of the work that Don Frank conveyed to us, that they were reproduced with the flat curve, that the engineers were basically making 3 files. The first one, they were capturing both groove walls, then they summed it to mono, and then they created a 4416. Here's just a picture of them scanning a barcode. I can't tell you how important it is to find a way to kind of automate your file names when they're complicated like this, because when people are typing them, all these errors come up and then you have to fix them after the fact when things don't match up. So that's really helped. This is an example, although hard to see, of a spreadsheet that the engineers kept. They tracked information about every transfer they did, including the date they transferred it, the file name, sound quality, the speed, the actual stylus they used, and other information. So it's quite detailed. Files were uploaded to a server once a week. The preservation files were placed on a different server than the access files were. And checksums were run on all the files. So we actually digitized at LC between 6,000 to 7,000 sites. That doesn't mean they're all ready to go yet. As you'll see, there are other factors and different issues can come up as we go along. So there was a lot of post-digitization work to do. One of the big things was verifying that the file name that the file actually had corresponded with what else we had in various databases. And so we had some lists. People had to go and compare the lists against what was actually on the barcodes on the sleeves, and we had to do a lot of adjusting. We also had to scan the labels. And in this example, you can see that the image looks slightly crooked on the screen that the technician's working on. And that's because we actually did try to make these kind of straight so you could see, you know, it wasn't completely crooked at LC. And this just is an example of the work done there. For the website, we had to create derivatives. They did not put the WAV files or the master, I think it was 400 DPI TIFF that we created for our images. And so this is just showing the derivatives that had to be created. And our automation specialist had to do this. So I was constantly sending lists once we knew that certain file names were verified, and he would run this process. Aside from checking copyright related to any recordings that came from 1923 to 1925, one of our last steps was editing metadata in the project database. So most of this information is from EDVR, and in this case, this is title information. Sometimes they didn't actually have a disk to look at when they were creating these entries for EDVR, so what the technicians would do is they would look at what's on the label, compare it with this, and if what they had on the label is different, they would create an entry for what was on the label as well. So you can still search all this information, but it just kind of filled it up a little bit. And this is the middle section. It mostly has to do with, it's not the middle section, the talent involved. And sometimes in the note field, there was something that said, say, take 6 through 7. If you were dealing with take five, you don't want the entry for somebody who is involved in take 6 through 7. So they would delete it. So it makes it more specific at the take level. And finally, at the very bottom of this, there are some genre fields. This, for something to go on and be added to the jukebox, at least one genre had to be assigned. So that absolutely had to happen. And then they had to check the digitized box if when they got to the file that our web developers would access, there was the 4416 and its two derivatives, and the TIFF file and its two derivatives. So they were looking specifically for 6 file names that all had the same file name. So that all had to be checked. If there was a problem with the metadata, they would click in progress at the bottom rather than complete. But the marker to the web developers that they could use this was that there wasn't a problem with copyright, it was digitized, and it was complete. As far as creating the website goes, we did have biweekly meetings with the development team for over a year. And that was interesting because that was held in DC, and from my perspective, I never got there, so I was always doing these phone meetings. But Sam and Jean and David Sager were often able to be present in DC. And in these meetings, we'd evaluate different issues, whether it was wireframes or somebody's suggestion to do something, and these are still ongoing meetings. And definitely determining which metadata elements should appear for specific things, and the order was huge. So that's basically my two presentations. And I'm now going to turn it over to David Soibert to talk about what happened with the UCSB collections.
Good morning. I'm going to talk a little bit about the West Coast operations. The EDVR, the Victor discography, obviously forms an integral part of the National Jukebox because it's the underlying metadata layer, basically. So if you look at the National Jukebox and you look at the EDVR website, they're very similar. The metadata is the same, and if it gets updated on the EDVR, it gets updated on the jukebox as well. But we've talked about the EDVR website at previous ARS conferences, so I'm not going to go into great detail about that. But when the Library of Congress forged the agreement with Sony to and got permission to digitize and put online the pre-1925 Victor catalog, because we were providing The agreement was that UCSB would be providing all of our Victor discography data to the library for free. That way, the Library of Congress would not have to basically recreate all of the existing metadata to start the jukebox. And in those negotiations and discussions, we decided, well, why don't we have a West Coast digitizing operation as well? And then UCSB's collection of Victor recordings can get digitized and added to the jukebox as well. And that was attractive for a couple of reasons. LC had been exploring mass digitization, and they wanted to experiment with doing multiple simultaneous transfers of recordings. Catlin, in her presentation, mentioned that LC digitized at their Culpeper campus 6,000 to 7,000 Victor recordings. UCSB, somewhere a similar number, around 6,000 to 7,000 sides from UCSB's collection were digitized as well, but not internally at UCSB with an engineer, but they were sent to a vendor in Seattle for an experiment in mass digitization, and that's what I'm going to be talking about here today. And in order to, the library knew that there were limitations to what they could do at Culpeper, not limitations in terms of the quality, but limitations in terms of the throughput. They have exceedingly high standards for the transfers, but they couldn't do in a short time frame, and this was originally conceived of as basically a start it and get it online in a year. It took more like 18 months or 2 years from sort of the start of the project to when it went on yesterday. But when you think about it, it was a very rapid, you know, the slowest part of the process was negotiating with Sony. And UCSB's collection also complemented the one at the Library of Congress and could be used for mass digitization. It complements in that they're different. We had different strengths than the libraries. We're probably stronger in collections of ethnic recordings and things like that. Catlin has showed some screenshots of the selection tool, and underlying the Victor discography, they developed this selection tool so that we both could be pulling records simultaneously for our collections, and we would know in real time whether a particular recording had gotten pulled for digitization. So we were both using this website that had been a project database that had been set up and began pulling discs. And that sort of relates to the slide, as we were sort of managing this by looking at Victor series number, and that's what's on that the handout there. So my staff were systematically pulling discs based on the Victor series number. LC really looked at it, took an approach of, they wanted specific types of content in the database, or in the jukebox. They wanted things like jazz and ragtime, because they wanted to create thematic playlists around that sort of thing. Or they wanted vaudeville, or they wanted opera. The approach that we took at Santa Barbara was, we're just going to go fill in the gaps. So we just went from the upper left-hand corner of the stacks to the lower right-hand corner and went through literally every acoustic Victor recording we have in the collection, and anything that LC had not already digitized, then we pulled. And that was, I don't know the numbers exactly, I'd have to look in the database, but the collection, the sheet there roughly says that something between 14 and 15,000 sides have been either digitized or been pulled for digitization. It's roughly half and half, although none of us have had the time to really get in and look at those numbers precisely. So that we pulled pretty much all of our Victor acoustic records, which is about 7,000. And then they were barcoded, and we put the barcode that you saw on Catlin's slide was the file name, and that way the digitizing staff wouldn't have to rekey a file name. They just wanted in a barcode, and it became the file name. And then these were boxed and shipped to Seattle. There's one of my staff pulling recordings to be shipped to Seattle. And there they're boxing them up. In discussions with the Library of Congress, because our vendor was in Seattle, we had to figure out how to get all the records to Seattle. And this was our primary working collection. It's not a new acquisition where you don't know whether it's all good or bad or whatever. You know, this was the weeded collection with no duplicates and all the best copies and alternate takes and things like that. And in discussions with Gene Deanna, he said, do what you need to do to get them to Seattle safely. So we decided to ship them to Seattle in a manner really that had zero risk of damage to collection. So we spent some time investigating schemes. So there's us, we would box up, we'd try to figure out different boxing schemes, and there's a box of 10-inch discs that we were throwing off the loading dock to see whether anything would break or not. And we did end up double boxing the collection with foam corners. So there's a box of 10-inch discs in a 10 by 10 cube packed inside of, I don't know what it is, a 14 by 14 cube, and then they were boxed up. So you could really throw these off a loading dock and the discs wouldn't break. That being said, they weren't shipped individually. We ended up sending 4 pallets of records to Seattle via truck, and we use a moving company that basically moves high-tech equipment around, satellites and chip fab equipment and things like that. And it's actually not that expensive, so if you're ever thinking about moving collections and or doing outsourcing, remote digitizing, there's plenty of ways to move around collections safely, and these kind of companies know how to do it. The vendor we used was a company called Reclaim Media in Seattle. I'd had some experience with them. They have this bargain basement cassette digitizing operation, and they'd also digitized LP libraries, including for you Angelenos, KCRW digitized their entire LP library a few years ago, and it was Reclaim in Seattle that had done that. And actually, they were the ones that had the foam corner idea originally. They do it by digitizing multiple sides simultaneously. With their LP operation, they digitized 16 LPs at once, and they'd also developed automated workflows for processing the files. So the files automatically, once the needle lifts off, the file gets trimmed and cropped and sent to a computer, and various things happen to it. We approached them, and Sam and I went up and visited and talked to them about modifying their digitizing process for 78 RPM disks. This actually proved to be much more complicated than you'd think. Part of it is that if you make the assumption that somebody that knows how to digitize or deal with LPs, really 78s are a different beast entirely, and it's in a different knowledge set, and there was a big learning curve on their part in terms of getting up to speed. The transfer process was similar to what was going on at Culpeper in some respects. Each label image was captured by the staff up in Seattle. Each disk was washed and vacuumed. They did stylus selection in advance with the aid of a digital microscope. And so there is the digital microscope, and there's the screen, and there's basically digital calipers on the screen. And they would have a technician that in advance then would go through 50 records or whatever, look at them under the microscope, examine the groove, and pre-select a stylus. And I think LC provided them with 4 stylus sizes, and I can't tell you what they are off the top of my head, but it was, the LC engineers had a whole range of sizes to choose from, and they used their ears and their expertise and their experience to choose that. The Reclaim Media people were trying to do a mechanized version of that, of making a best choice among limited options. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. And then they transferred 4 records at a time, not 16. You can't transfer 16 3-minute records at a time. It's just not possible. And there's their setup where they have the turntables. And you can see the little light switches underneath the turntables. Basically, I don't know exactly, their process is a bit opaque, but the switches turn on and off the directly control the computers. These are all interfaced with some sort of serial interface. They did a flat transfer at 2496. The records were actually transferred to 33 and a third. There's 2 reasons for that. One is they didn't have their existing turntables were 33 and a third turntables. The second reason is when you're transferring at 78, you have to change records a lot faster. So transferring them slower allowed them to set up, turn them on, and then get the next batch ready, where if they'd been going at 78, they would have really probably been only able to transfer, you know, maybe a couple at a time. So it was sort of a practical decision, and that was entirely a practical decision. And then they used their automated process for trimming files and correcting speeds. Then the images and the WAV files were sent to LC and UC Santa Barbara. So some of the results, multiple simultaneous transfer is feasible. The cost per side was pretty low, about $7.50 per side. The packing and shipping was actually much more time consuming, and not a lot more expensive, but more expensive than we thought it would be in the beginning. And you know, if you go on the jukebox and look at the files that are made that are from Santa Barbara collection versus the ones that are from LC's collection, there is a definite difference in quality with the files. And there is, you know, you make trade-offs that the quality of the files that we're doing from four at a time mass digitization are not as high quality as those done by LC's professional engineers at Culpeper. I think there's a lot of things here that we all need to discuss over time. I mean, we've not had a real opportunity to sit down and sort of troubleshoot and talk through things, but I think that there's a lot more learning here to happen about what was good ideas that came out of this and what was bad ideas out of this. One of the things that I think is that the visual stylus selection, I don't know that there's any sort of scientific basis for coming up with appropriate stylus based on looking at the record. I think you just gotta listen. You can't, you know, if you've played, you swap out a couple and one of them hits it right and sounds great and one of them sounds terrible and it's full of swish, and you just, I don't think you can predict that. I mean, maybe we could scientifically prove that at some point. That's basically the operations that went on the West Coast to help populate the jukebox. And it was a component that allowed LC to achieve their goal of getting 10,000 sides online at launch. So I thank you. And are we taking questions after Seger? Or?
I'm going to say a few words and then we'll
yeah.
So that in about 40 minutes is how 10,300 recordings were digitized. I just want to say a few things in conclusion. I mean, this has been an incredible learning process for everyone. And it's also been a very positive process. Everyone who's worked on this project has really been great. We've had the best IT support I've ever seen at the Library of Congress. The people who develop the website, you come to them with an idea to try something new, and they just roll up their sleeves and are ready to try it. You'll find no other Library of Congress website like this one. But I think we also learned a lot of things. I'm prejudiced, but I'm very pleased that the discography was used, in part because the discography was a way to control or reduce redundancy. That is to say, the discography tracks matrix numbers, takes, and you know, master numbers and take combinations to try to assure that if one is selected off a single face red seal, that you don't run across the double face red seal that came out 20 years later and say, oh, we haven't done this. The discography prevented that, or at least when we got the thing rolling, it did. In addition to helping with the cataloging, the Catlin staff added to that cataloging with genres, and also, you know, finding things on the label that we never saw. We had, I think, actually this whole thing with the foam corners and the shipping we learned a lot about. We learned a lot about just workflow preservation, this idea of signing a file name to a preservation file before it goes to the laboratory and having it on a barcode so that you can track the file and there's not a typo with someone typing it in after it's done. It was done with the barcode reader if you saw that. So what's ahead? Well, we're going to do more records. We're going to start with more Victor records and finish up the collections in both institutions. We hope to have more public and private partners. We hope to have private partners who, collectors who contribute individual records. We want to get every record mentioned in that Victrola Book of the Opera in that interactive book so that you can click on every single one, where some of them have been done but we just haven't finished, but some of them we have a list of things we haven't found yet. Mostly the ones we haven't found are EMI, or rather Gramophone Company imports that came out on the Victor label. So we might come to you or put something in the Ars newsletter. Does anyone have these? Maybe we have a way that people make files and contribute them, but also large institutional partners. We'd like to add other labels. We hope that the Park Service, that Jerry Faberson, the Edison site, might be able to add some Edison. The Library of Congress has a large collection you've read about with Universal Music Group. They are open in theory. You know, that is in the agreement. We will consider adding things to the jukebox, but that isn't happened yet. So in the meantime, we have Columbia and OK and all these other Sony labels to do. And to do that, we hope, that is we, David, and I hope to be able to take the Victor discography and extend it to other labels. Now, I've been up here for 35 years talking about big discographies, and we're still going to the same funders looking for that. I hope that maybe next year we can report that we've done that, and we will have a Columbia discography or something, or Berliner discography, to sort of track the same things. Dawn Frank, who oversaw the engineering, she said she'd love to sort of have an experiment to digitize a lot, every recording, maybe not all 30 the Library of Congress has of a title, but a lot, and try to see which one the best is through some sort of post-processing. These are just dreams of things that we would like to use this project to experiment with. So that's the big, in addition, we will be digitizing things in our lab at University of California, Santa Barbara. I think the reclaim experiment was very interesting. In some ways it worked, in other ways it didn't. I think personally the main thing that didn't work is the fact that it's sort of in Seattle and we're in Washington and Santa Barbara. It's very hard to just sort of coordinate all that when someone's not on site. So David will be working with the library to have digitization in our own laboratory in Santa Barbara. So. That's it. Thanks. Yeah. Actually, are you going to introduce David, or I will? Okay.
Catlin and I counted last night, and 50 people worked on this. I don't know. There were very, very, very few people were full-time on it, but there were 50 individuals, somewhere around between 25 and 30 at the Library of Congress, both in Washington and in Virginia. We had three programmers in New York City. We had four people in Seattle, and we had seven people in Santa Barbara.
Four programmers in New York City, actually.
Yeah, so for some of us, it was a few hours here and there of our time, and some people, it was most of their time. But it was an incredibly, incredibly complicated and big project, and it's, I think, we're all sort of surprised it actually happened.
They have time for questions, so, Barry?
No. Sony came down and there was an event at the Library of Congress. I sort of hope it's on the website. It was a nice press conference. Harry Connick came and they played this. I wish Peter Schamberger had been there. They played a video of Harry Connick at age 8 playing a duet with Ubi Blake. I'm Just Wild About Harry. And then Harry Connick performed I'm Just Wild About Harry. He is a fantastic pianist. It's really a fine jazz musician, and then he commented a little bit on the jukebox. No, we don't know anything. I mean, David talked about how long it took to negotiate the agreement. It wasn't negotiating the agreement that took so long. It was, you know, we knew what we wanted, and they said what they would do and what they wouldn't do, but it took a long time to get it signed. There are no Goddard Liebersons in the record industry anymore among the majors, where there's one person in charge who can make a decision and not worry about whether they'll lose their job the next day. Getting it signed was the hardest. But anyway, we hope they'll be more positive. The Library of Congress is going to report user statistics, not people, but just that, Henry Burr's really getting a lot of hits or something. And then they'll put out that box set. Or maybe if they don't cooperate, we'll tell them Henry Burr's getting a lot of hits. So they put out the box set. In any case, it's been a very good relationship with them. They've been very good to our discography project, but they've been very hands-off as well. I mean, this has been the Library of Congress's work. Sony gave the rights, but all the fundings come from other sources.
Mike?
Are we going to see the rotational speed and the stylus selection?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
No.
No.
Any other questions? I mean, I think that Dawn has that, but it's not included in the metadata that's included, that's put on the web.
Yeah. Jerry?
Gene Deanna and I had discussed what would go in, and I don't, you know, well, I don't think that's true. Maybe I had said that I didn't want the UCSB cylinder collection in the National Jukebox. The Edison cylinders, yeah. No, I thought that was all worked out because I told Gene that he should make the decision that he thought was best for the jukebox, and that if he wanted to include cylinders or diamond discs or needle types, that he should go for it. So
this is an important point, and it's something about, it's not just politics, but it's also about institutional identity. Institutions don't want to do a lot of work and then have it all go up under the Library of Congress banner or someone else's banner. And to the extent that David decided that, you know, that he had put in a lot of work into the cylinder project, and just to have it sucked into National Jukebox and the identity of Santa Barbara and all the work they've done to be subsumed by it isn't acceptable. However, you know, as we think about the future, and while I wasn't aware that Gene categorically, you know, said no cylinders, I think it was really just about not taking over David's site. But anyway, maybe the jukebox can become a portal to where it's one place where you search metadata of what's been digitized nationally, and then if you click on something and it's at Santa Barbara, you go there, but the Santa Barbara cataloging will be there. It's a possibility, and I think it would be a good way to get more institutions that need to get their own funding and not just be part of the Library of Congress. It's a possibility.
We have time for one more person to turn one more screw. Kurt?
I just wanted to know, do you have a figure for what it costs the Library of Congress to transfer per side?
Yeah, a lot. per side? No, I don't. I mean, none of us are in charge there.
They could do four sides an hour, but you'd have to do a FOIA request to find out the salaries and the overhead.
And the legislative branch is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. So, I mean, you could probably figure it out. But is it four sides an hour? And that would include
four sides.
Everything? Does that include cleaning?
No, it does not.
No. So it is a lot. It is a lot. But I think you get what you pay for. You're going to hear the difference between the mass digitization and the individual digitized.
The public won't necessarily. You know, they just think they're old scratchy recordings. But, I mean, if you guys listen, you'll definitely hear differences.
Good. Thanks. Thanks a lot. We have to move on.
You want to stay here?
Yeah. If you'd like.